Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world.
Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. And this is me, your host, Yag. In today's episode, we are going to discuss how you can leverage referrals and partnerships the right way for customer acquisition. And who better to discuss it with than the chief advocate of the company that's known for referrals. Today, we have with us Raul Galera, the chief advocate at Referral Candy, an app that allows e-commerce brands to set up and run customer referral programs. Founded over 10 years ago, Referral Candy has helped over 30,000 brands leverage the power of word of mouth and turn their customer base into their marketing team. Raul has been leading Referral Candy's partnership efforts for the past 5 years, and he's been working alongside marketing agencies, media, and tech companies. And that is why I believe we can learn so much from him today. So without any further ado, Raul, this is your prime time and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm super excited. All right, so let's get going. You know, let's start with the understanding of the role of referrals and partnerships in customer acquisition and retention. A lot of companies start the referral program as an afterthought. In fact, at Avoma, when we saw our customers referring us to the network almost every other day, we realized that there's a need to appreciate and reward the customers who are referring us out of their goodwill. And that's how we built our referral system into the platform. But you've been in this domain for ages now. So can you give us an overview of how loyalty and referral programs improve the customer acquisition and retention? And maybe if you can also talk a little bit about what's the right time or stage for any company to think about a referral system?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for background, honestly, the example that you just mentioned about what you guys did at Avoma for your own referral program—it's honestly the most typical case scenario for a company starting a referral program is that you have a good product, your customers love it, and they just organically start talking about it, and you start getting these organic referrals, and then from that moment on, you just realize, okay, well, you know, there must be something that we can do to improve this and to get our customers to refer even more. And that's when referral marketing and referral programs kind of come along. So, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, but when you think about it, we love to share experiences and we love to share stuff that we've also bought because, you know, shopping, it's part of our daily lives. So for e-commerce, referral programs work really well because, again, we just love talking about products that we have acquired. So for the company side, once you have a product that it's selling well, once you have a system in place that makes sure that your customers are happy, you have a customer support team that's, you know, solving their issues or even proactively, you know, solving any sort of problems before they even get to the customer, and the customer's, you know, happy that it's that spend their money on their product, they're definitely going to talk about it. But if you incentivize them to do so with a referral program, you're not only going to incentivize them to refer and incentivize them to get their friends to buy from your store, but at the same time, you can also adjust these rewards so your customers are also incentivized to buy again from you. Think about it. If you give discounts to both your customers and their friends, your customer's going to get rewarded with a discount on their next purchase for every friend that they refer. So there you go. You're not only acquiring new customers, you're retaining your existing ones. So that's kind of how referrals typically come to play.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense. And in the same vein, let's also touch a little bit about the partnership aspects. You know, partnerships are also a lot like referrals, but holistically speaking, they are a little more strategic. And you, Raul, have worked with a lot of agencies. And when an agency and a tech platform work together as partners, there's more than just affiliates or reselling. You know, it's typically about the set of services that an agency can offer to help their client. So in that course, implementing or customizing your product according to the client's larger goals is where the actual game is. But what, according to you, are the set of things that you would want a tech company to check before somebody calls themselves partnership ready?
Yeah. So honestly, I would follow the same path as the one that I just mentioned for kind of like a traditional e-commerce referral program. Is you have a good product and you have kind of partnership opportunities popping up. And that's actually what happened at Referral Candy. When I joined the company, so the company was like 5 years old, and they had already experienced some sort of, you know, partnerships, like agencies reaching out and asking for options for agencies. I mean, agencies are kind of used to working with tech companies and, you know, in this kind of like, you know, partnership account management type of setup. And so they started getting requests from agencies that wanted to work with Referral Candy. And then I kind of came along and we started to launch this partner program that continues today. So I think if you're looking for the sign that tells you you're probably ready for partnerships, it's definitely the fact that you're getting organic requests, legit organic requests for partnerships. So if you're a SaaS company in, targeting, I want to think of the typical scenario for e-commerce, kind of like Shopify apps. If you're a Shopify app and you get a Shopify agency reaching out to you and say, hey, I have like 50 clients that could definitely use your app. You know, what's the process like? That's, you know, obviously that's the right time. Another way to kind of like figure this out, it's not only if agencies reach out to you, but kind of like take a deeper look at who your customers are and see if they are maybe running the account for somebody else. That's something that I personally do on a regular basis. When I look at some accounts that maybe the person that's running the account or the email address doesn't kind of match with the company that's running the referral program, I investigate a little bit deeper and then I see that's an agency that's kind of running a program for somebody else. So I would say start looking internally for those signs. Otherwise, if you are a company that have been around for a while and you have kind of like a proven, you know, track record of happy customers, honestly, just reach out to potential partners, partners that you think are going to be a good fit for you. It doesn't have to be agencies. I mean, it has to really depends on the industry, but just, you know, reach out, email or LinkedIn, whatever it is. I've done it myself. And I mean, it's a really good way of start acquiring potential partners. They probably don't convert as well or as quickly as inbound ones, but it also works.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I ask this question is like, you know, there's a certain difference between when you go as a referral versus going in as a partner. Like say, for example, when something comes in as an inbound lead, yes, there are people in your company who can demo your product or whatever, if it's a completely self-serve, it's like straightforward. But when you're empowering another agency or somebody in the middle path, where they are the ones who are going to scale it for other people. So you have to empower them with a set of things that they need, and they need to be trained and things like that. So I was trying to get at that as to what does the getting ready path look like?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So in that sense, at least the approach that I follow is to provide value, additional value on top of what the product already provides, or in case the app. And so in that sense, at least in the kind of like the world that we work with, which is mostly small and medium companies, the kind of like the compensation or kind of like the affiliate payout for agencies, it's not, or for partners in general, it's not really that big of a driver for them because they have other priorities. So we've realized that providing something on top of that, so providing training, providing demos, having kind of like a direct communication channel with a company for support matters, or for, you know, if anything happens really, or if they need to run a demo for the client, we can jump in and, you know, do the demo for the client directly. So, you know, basically just make their life easier. That's what we've realized that works best for, at least in kind of like the industry that we work with. This might not be the case for maybe enterprise software. So if you're selling licenses for like tens of thousands of dollars, then, you know, maybe that the training, it's a little bit deeper. Maybe you need to have some sort of like certification process to make sure that your resellers are, you know, effectively selling the product well, and that's not going to lead to support problems in the future. And obviously the payout, it makes a lot more, it brings a lot more to the table than an app that has like a typical monthly subscription. So again, it's different worlds, but in my opinion, it's all about just making sure that the partner is offering a product or service to the client, that fits their needs. And so if you can add value on top of what your product already does, then that's a win-win.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. Now, let me ask you a super tactical question and also probably $1 million question here. how to stay on top of mind or give your customers an incentive to talk about you? I mean, given your background, do you have a set of steps or things to do right from the moment you're thinking of setting up a referral program?
Yeah, so I mean, that's exactly the main driver of the success of our referral program is to stay top of mind. So you know, obviously we're surrounded by ads and just content marketing in general is trying to grab our attention all the time. So we need to stay visible. So we typically recommend our merchants to run email drip campaigns, reminding about the referral program. So just to, again, just kind of stay top of mind, to write content about the referral program. So also when they distribute that across different channels, their customers remember that there's something that they can benefit from. Anything along the lines of social media. We've also seen some pretty creative ways of inviting people to join the program or kind of reminding them that they have a referral link that they can share. It's just by sometimes adding kind of like a card in the box that the customer receives at their house. So you know, things like this, anything that you can really do to stay top of mind works really well. But it's all about just reminders. Just make sure that your customers, whenever they see something about your brand, they're not just expecting kind of like a deal or a discount or just kind of like the typical quick promotion, you know, advertisement, but they're also seeing educational content. And also with educational content, it comes content about the referral program, which is something that they can themselves benefit from.
So the key learning for me here is that, you know, move beyond transactions and, you know, keep it helpful as much possible.
Yeah, exactly. And you can go even deeper than that and do what a lot of companies are doing, which is to build a community around your brand. So building a community, it's basically figuring out what is that unites all of your customers with themselves and also with your brand, and then create a place where you can share stuff with them. And then hopefully also your clients can share stuff with each other. So we have multiple examples of this, of companies that are selling from books to clothing, in which they create maybe Facebook groups in which customers can exchange maybe what's the latest book that they're reading, or maybe they can share about, you know, particular values that they all happen to share. So it's about creating this spaces, and this creates a more personal, kind of deeper connection with the brand. And then once you have that in place, once you have, again, a community, a group of people that it's so obsessed with your brand that are interact with other people that are kind of like-minded, the referral program just takes off from there. We've seen a lot of examples of companies that being able to leverage that. And it's not either or. I mean, you don't need to have a referral program to have a community, and you don't need a community to have a referral program. But when you combine both things, that really takes off. So again, if it really depends on what your product does and kind of like, you know, what how deep you can go into this personal connection with customers. But different touch points to remind about the referral program would be my number one. And then creating a community will be kind of like a next level approach for referral marketing, but also just as overall branding. It really helps in the long run.
Absolutely love this. Can't agree more. And when we talk of referrals, you know, we are more often than not thinking of volume. The point I'm trying to get through this is, you know, I think though referral programs tend to target all customers, at some point, we also need to know who VIP customers are. Mm-hmm. So does segmentation have a role in the referral system?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and actually to address both points, so the volume really, really helps. And I think we mentioned earlier when would be a good time for a brand to start a referral program. And obviously having some sort of volume really helps in order to be able to see results in the kind of like short, midterm. Otherwise, it's probably going to take a little longer for a referral program to take off if you don't have that many new customers joining the program, or if you have that many orders. So again, volume, it's really important, but also segmentation. So one strategy that a lot of merchants are doing is that they are running a referral program for customers. Think about the typical, give $10, get $10 in discount, something along those lines. And then they are keeping track of who are the customers that are referring the most friends. That's actually a feature that we have on Referral Candy. You can see kind of like a ranking of your top advocates. Right. And so what they're doing with that is that they're creating a separate referral program just for those top customers, and maybe also for influencers. And they're offering a different set of rewards. So they might be offering a free product instead of a discount, or they might be offering a cash reward. So segmentation really helps, especially for those kind of like top advocates, for which, you know, at some point they're probably getting so many rewards that it makes more sense to kind of like level up a little bit and give them something different.
Right. So like, if I think of an e-commerce model, is it more like RFM segmentation kind of a system?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a little bit different in the sense that you're keeping track of, in this case, you're keeping track of how many friends are these customers referring, and it's like, kind of like a different activity. And then you will have to kind of like manually introduce these customers to this secondary or this kind of like private or VIP referral program, if you want to call it like that. But yeah, I mean, it works pretty much the same way as you would segment customers based on other activity.
Right. Amazing. And one of the key aspects that I would love for you to touch upon is the mistakes to avoid, or maybe a case study to learn from. Are there any case studies that you would like to talk about? Feel free not to name the customer, but if you want to take us through some of the key mistakes to avoid, that'll be fantastic.
Yeah. So in terms of mistakes, I would say that it's probably kind of based on expectations. So referral marketing has a lot to do, at the end of the day, has a lot to do with how your business is currently doing. So referral marketing can empower what's already happening, the referrals that might be happening organically, and kind of like the activity that your customers are doing in terms of maybe talking to their friends and family about your product. It can boost that, but it needs to, again, like I said earlier, it needs volume to play with. This is a numbers game at the end of the day. And also needs to have a pool of customers that you can keep inviting to the program. So sometimes with expectations that maybe brands that are not having as many orders per month or not maybe adding as many customers to the referral program on a daily or a weekly basis, they're not seeing results right away. And it's because it takes time. We're dealing with people. And so if you run an NPS, Net Promoter Score survey on your customers, and you ask them if they would be willing to refer, even if you get 90% of your customers saying, yes, I'll be willing to refer, we've seen that only a fraction of those will actually end up referring. And it's, yes. And it's not because they don't like your brand or anything like that. It's just, you know, there's a lot of things that have Exactly. There's all other things that happen in our daily life. So we need volume. And so brands sometimes kind of like overlook that part. And maybe they also, they don't necessarily do as much promotion as they should. Those are probably the two main I wouldn't call them mistakes, because they're not really mistakes, but they're probably the main kind of like bottlenecks that we see on referral programs.
Right. So if I put this into a SaaS kind of a company or that kind of a setup, would you say that there needs to be someone full time handling referrals?
I guess it depends. Even for SaaS, I mean, there's a lot of companies that allow SaaS companies to run referral programs, and it's all pretty much automated. I mean, I don't think, unless we're talking about, again, big volumes and maybe including resellers in the mix, I would say anything that's not maybe working with transactions or like making sure that affiliate payouts are getting sent and all that kind of stuff, which can be automated. But if there's more to that, and you know, like we mentioned earlier, if there's some sort of like maybe training involved, or maybe there's you need to distribute some sort of like promotional assets to affiliates so they can go out and refer properly, maybe you do need somebody that kind of works on that. But otherwise, if we're just talking about the traditional referral link, referral code, setup, and automated rewards, it's all pretty much on autopilot.
Right. Makes sense. All right. So we are now getting towards the second half of the podcast, which we call the rapid fire section. So I'm going to throw some lightning questions at you. There are going to be five of them. And the questions might be short, might be pointed. The idea is to put you on the spot. And let's see how that goes. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
All right. So here's question number one, at the risk of getting you beaten up. So what's the first adjective that comes to your mind when I say marketing to agencies?
Ah, good question. I would say adding value. It's not really an adjective, but something that kind of pops to mind based on what I mentioned earlier about how sometimes when you're dealing with agencies, they're not your final customer, so you need to help them provide value to their actual customer. So that's why I would mention that.
Right. All right. So I was trying to get your emotion when working with agencies, but yeah, this is okay too.
I would say that sometimes it's an interesting relationship with agencies in the sense yes. In the sense that again, the agencies are your client, but your clients are also your clients as well. And there's like kind of like this relationship, but you know that they're you're not their main priority. So yes. you're running a partnership with them. But you always need to keep in mind that, your part of the deal is replaceable yes. as a service provider. And so it's, you know, it's to me, it's always, I'm not going to say stressful, but it's always, you know, just trying to make sure that, that they're happy, that they have everything they need and kind of like get proactively try to figure out if there's any sort of issue coming down the road. So that's, yeah, I don't want to say stressful, but it's kind of that, you know, it's kind of like staying, trying to stay ahead of what might be coming next. Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't really thought about that before.
Yeah. I love this. I love this part. All right. So here's question number two. If you had to pick just one of the two, would you build a community or would you build a referral program?
I will build a community.
Okay. Any reasons for that?
Yeah, because building a community, I mean, it's definitely going to help with your referral program if you decide to launch one down the line. It's also just going to generate referrals organically, so that also helps. And then at the end of the day, it's going to position your brand. It's going to put your brand in a very strong position versus your competitors, because the fact that you've been able to create a personal connection with your customers, that's really hard to replace. And it's really hard to replace by another brand that might be coming up. And I always like to give this example because I think they've done it very well. The clothing brand Patagonia,
yeah.
They took this a few years ago, they decided to get political. And they decided to share their kind of like the company beliefs, and at the risk of maybe alienating part of their customer base. But what they did is that their customers who were already loyal customers got even more loyal after that, yeah. And they were even more enthusiastic about the brand. That's an example I always like to share. I mean, I personally like the brand, and I think what they've done there is really smart. So yeah, that's why I will definitely build a community. And it doesn't have to be an online group or so like a forum or a Facebook group or a Slack group or anything like that. It can really just be creating a place where you can share content that goes beyond your products with your customers.
Absolutely love that. You're absolutely killing this round.
Great.
So here's question number three. What's your natural style of decision-making? Is it data-driven or is it intuitive?
I think intuition plays a big role in how I make decisions. I mean, I try more and more. I mean, I always like try to look at the data and try to look at numbers to kind of make sure that I'm on the right path or not. I mean, or maybe just to prove my intuition wrong. But if I have to choose one or kind of like the one that I use in my daily life, it's definitely intuition.
Amazing. Love that. All right. So here's question number four. You know, you've been working remotely since 2012, ever since your first internship, probably. And interestingly, you come from a family of teachers. So how did you explain remote work to them?
Well, my parents, I don't think they still really understand what I do, okay. Or pretty much anybody in my family. I've tried to explain a bunch of times, but you know, this kind of like weird mix between sales and marketing. It's kind of difficult to understand, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it was definitely shocking for my parents and for my family in general when I started working remotely, because my first internship ever was remote, and in 2012 that was definitely not normal. Wow. And so that was, yeah, they were like, wait, you don't have to go to an office? So it was kind of hard to understand. But I mean, the explanation that I've always given to anybody is that I work for a Singapore company, and my customers are in Europe or in Asia or in the US.
Yeah,
I can't go visit all of them in person. And it honestly doesn't even make sense for me to do so. So, you know, I can just be anywhere. I can be in my bedroom and, you know, having calls with a bunch of different countries in one day. So when you put it that way, that most people, you know, really understand that even before COVID. Obviously now with COVID, everybody's realizing that you can maintain a company afloat by working from your dining table. But yeah, back then, but not only my parents, to be honest, I mean, it was difficult to explain sometimes what I was doing to companies that we're talking to. They were asking me like, oh, you know, where's your office? And I had to say, no, this is actually my living room. So, so yeah, right. Now, it wasn't even that common in the tech world, just a handful of years ago.
Right, right. In fact, I started working remote from 2016. It was a little weird for me back then. But now the only difference from there to now is that the kids used to go to school, now they're around. So that's the major difference.
Yeah. Yeah. I always say that I'm totally unqualified to go back to an office. I actually, after I did my first internship, and I worked for that company for like a year and a half, 2 years, remote. And then I actually decided to find an office job. I wanted to be in an office and see what it was like. But then 2 years later, I was like, okay, no, I'm going back to the remote setup.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, so here's the final rapid fire question. Today, we are in an asynchronous world. And from the first time we spoke to now, each time I hear that you are in a different country in a different time zone. So would you say you are a remote first person or a remote friendly person?
Remote first.
Okay. And for the listeners, if you can explain the difference between the two.
Yeah, so I personally made the decision to go remote again in 2016, and I was, you know, specifically looking for a company for which I could work remotely, and Referral Candy was that. And Referral Candy is actually not remote first, but it's remote friendly, and so that's why in 2016 I could work for Referral Candy, whether I was in Spain or in the US or in Colombia or, you know, wherever I was, we never really saw any sort of issues in that. And before COVID, we had people working from our headquarters in Singapore, and then we had a bunch of people like me that work remotely, a lot of them in the Philippines. And now, obviously, with COVID, everybody started working from home. Most of them are still in Singapore. So I believe that once this, you know, once like restrictions start lifting, I think we'll probably go back to having some sort of office, but maybe with some sort of flexible schedule. We still haven't really figured it out for those who are in Singapore, because they're all in the same city. It kind of makes sense that at least they see each other at least a couple times a week. So yeah, we're remote friendly in that sense. And also before COVID, we had an office in Singapore, but you were, you know, free to work from home if you wanted to. You didn't have to go to the office every day or anything like that. So yeah, I would say I don't know exactly what it's going to look like in about a year if we have this conversation again. But right now, yeah, that's kind of like our current setup.
Right. So what, according to you, is the major difference between being remote first versus remote friendly?
I would say the main difference is that a company that's remote friendly still wants to have some sort of in-person structure in one way or another. And then it's friendly in the sense that it's open to find talent anywhere in the world. Which again, it was kind of my case when I interviewed for Referral Candy in 2016. I had just gone back to Spain from living in Chile, and you know, nobody at the company saw an issue on that, because they thought it would be the right person for that particular role that we were starting at that moment. But most of the roles that we're hiring for, or back then we were hiring for, were to be based in Singapore. And so it's more like, if we can find a good candidate in Singapore, great, because they can just work from the office. But if we happen to find the absolute perfect candidate and it's just based anywhere else in the world, you know, it will be stupid for us to kind of pass on that person. So I feel like that's probably the main difference, is having some sort of priority into being able to see somebody face to face.
I absolutely love this story. In fact, you know, I'm thinking of the way I joined Avoma. It's like I work in a totally different time zone out of India, and everybody else, like say my CEO and my sales team, works in the PST time zone. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's completely async, and I'm absolutely loving this. I mean, we do have sync up calls, but yeah, majority of the times is like, you know, it feels like we are working around the clock. I work in my morning. When I'm sleeping, like, those guys are working, so the company's always alive.
Yep. Yeah, that's another great way to see it, to be honest, that I sometimes was able to, you know, figure stuff out before they joined the office, or the other way around. Like, hey, you know, I'm going to sleep, but can you guys keep an eye on, you know, maybe this particular client, or, you know, whatever it is. So the fact that there's always somebody that's awake and can jump in if it's needed for, you know, for some particular cases, that makes sense. And again, I mean, there's obviously no way around the time zones. Sometimes I've had to have calls at midnight or 10 p.m., you know, or 11 or whatever it is. That's okay. I mean, that's, or even early in the morning. Sometimes we have our all hands meetings, and that's at like 6, 5 a.m. my time, depending on the daylight changes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but that's kind of the price to pay, and I'm happy to pay that price.
Amazing. You know, you absolutely hit all the rapid fire questions out of the park. That was fantastic.
Great.
All right. So before I thank you and let you go, I would like to ask you if you have a parting message that you would like to share with our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess to kind of like summarize everything that we discussed in terms of referral programs and partnerships. So again, if you are if you're a software company or e-commerce company, and you are already seeing signs that you might be either getting people that want to partner with you, or you have existing clients that are referring you to other coworkers or friends and family, depends on the industry that you're working on, don't ignore those signs. Try to at least investigate, you know, talk to those people, figure out why, what's their motivation behind the fact that they are either referring you to people they know, or why they want to partner with you. Try to learn more, even if it doesn't lead to something right away. I think it would help you down the line figure it out, what's kind of the path that you want to take as a company down the collaborations route, or down the referral marketing route. So pay attention to those early signs. They're usually a really good indicator that as a company, you're doing the right thing.
Absolutely love that message. I had to learn some of these lessons the hard way, but yeah, I absolutely understand where you come from. All right. So if the listeners of the podcast would like to get in touch with you, what is the best way to connect, and where can people find you?
Yeah, so best place to connect with me is my email. So that's Raul G, so R-A-U-L-G at referralcandy.com. I'm always happy to take questions or start a conversation there. And then they can just find us on referralcandy.com or Twitter, Instagram accounts at referralcandy.
Amazing. All right. So thank you so much, Raul. That was absolutely fantastic. I loved every single thing that you said. And I'm going to go back and probably take a lot of notes from this conversation. Unfortunately, this was not recorded on Avoma.
Ah.
So, all right. So thank you once again, Raul. You've been fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure. I had a lot of fun.
Same here. And for the listeners of the podcast, that's that from us in this episode. And we'll connect with you the next time with another guest and another interesting topic. Until then, this is bye from me, Yag. Have a good day and take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback. thoughts and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.